Hey, everybody. Welcome to Latter-day Struggles. This is your host, Valerie. Pleased and delighted to be with each of you all today here for a part three of a four-part series where Nathan and I have chosen to do a deep dive into all things having to do with the sacrament here in and around, not in around, here in. The sacrament happens in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So, hi, Nathan.
Hi. We have actually talked a little bit about the sacrament around the church. If you think about, we've talked about the sacrament in other communities and traditions, and in a broader sense, I think in and around is appropriate.
You know what? I stand corrected. And yeah. I don't mind being corrected all the time, as you know, from being my husband. Very good at, you know, I'm just kidding. I've gotten better. Am I wrong?
We both have learned how to be humble.
We have learned how to stand corrected.
Yes.
So yes, I do stand corrected there. That is absolutely right. Nathan makes an excellent point that we are trying to expand the definition of the sacrament. As we're so good at talking about, we love this concept of faith expansion, inclusive of all of the minutiae connected to faith itself. We believe in expanding pretty much every definition of each and every piece of the theology. I think that's actually true. Yeah.
I do too.
We are into expansion on every level. Okay. So I'm going to put you on the spot, babe. And I would like for you, if you would, to do a broad overview of the first two episodes that we have covered thus far.
Sure.
And then we'll jump into episode number three.
Yeah. So in our first episode, we started with some basic definitions of the sacrament, both in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and also the sacraments of other faiths. And specifically, we looked a little bit at the Catholic faith because their faith tradition is so old. They have a lot of theology, a lot of writings, a lot of study around the symbolism there. And then we talked a little bit about the connection between the sacrament and the Passover. And then we talked in episode one a little bit about the connections between sacraments or physical ordinances and embodied ordinances and the way that our psyches respond to things that involve the emotions, the body, and the mind simultaneously, like a sacrament, like taking the sacrament. And then in episode two, we started to talk a little bit more deeply about that last concept, which was the idea that the sacrament in and of itself is sort of a value neutral ordinance or participation, but it has a lot more to do with the meaning we make of it, and that we, as members of the church and as members of any sort of faith community, should be looking for ways to make the sacraments more expansive, to use them as ways of connecting with the divine. And that sometimes, unfortunately, in all faith traditions, but especially in ours, sometimes we do the opposite. We make sacraments and ordinances in general as ways not to connect to the divine and to connect to others, but as to separate ourselves. And we specifically use the languaging of setting apart, which we frequently use in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And talked about the dangers of the concept of setting ourselves apart as opposed to setting ourselves within and integrating more. And the sacrament ought to be an opportunity to integrate. We also touched on the idea that the sacrament is not for perfect people and that it's not a forgiveness system or a transactional system, but should be an opportunity for contemplation, for connection to the present moment, for connection to God's self and others, and as a way to grow and expand, not a way to self-castigate. So these are just kind of some of the points we touched on, and we will keep moving forward.
Thank you, babe. So yes, I love that. The big theme of last time was really taking the concept of setting apart and talking about what that means and how in some ways that does not help us become closer to who we are here to become. We don't want to set ourselves apart from others. We also don't want to set the concept of sacrament so apart from what it means to be human that we diminish how everything in life is in fact a sacrament. So can the sacrament be a beautiful, holy way of communion on a Sunday morning in a church with bread and water? Yes, it can. But it can be so much more as well. So, okay, so today as our part three, as we promised, we are going to jump into some of the ways in which we sadly feel that the concept of and the practice of sacrament has gone wrong. I guess I'm going to just say it that directly. And again, I always like to open these kinds of conversations up with my feeling that I do not believe that there is ever any poor intent. I don't believe that there are motives to hurt. I believe that people are well-meaning on the ward, the stake, and the general level when it comes to any theological idea, practice, or tradition. But I don't think that's the same as it not being harmful. I think some things can be very harmful, and some things can actually be abusive when they are used in certain ways to garner either control or when they're used as a punishment and reward system. The sacrament is a really big piece of this conversation. And I was very interested in learning when I was studying about the sacrament, as we call it in the LDS faith, but it's also, this is inclusive of also the communion or the Eucharist in other faith traditions, that other faith traditions struggle with this as well. They've taken this concept of the sacrament as a holy communion, and in larger Christianity, it has been turned into a reward punishment system elsewhere as well. So what this says to me is human nature sometimes bends towards corruption or bends towards the warping of things that are beautifully simple. And I think it has to do with anxiety. I think it has to do with hierarchy. I think it has to do with fear, power, and control. And how people, when we are feeling power or when we are feeling wounded and frightened in systems of hierarchy, we sometimes do things to wield power over those over whom we have power. And unfortunately, that happens in the sacraments. So I'm not here to be critical, but I am here to be candid.
Yeah, so the idea of using sacrament, we touched on this a little bit in our temple series as well with the temple recommend. I like to turn the logic on its head, right? So to me, when we talk about the sacrament is a tool that helps us to move into a closer relationship with our heavenly parents, with our Savior Jesus Christ, with our own brothers and sisters. And it's become a reward system for having already done that instead of a tool to get there. And so when people say, oh, I wasn't worthy to take the sacrament, so, you know, the bishop told me not to, to me, that is actually the antithesis of what the sacrament was intended for.
Can I throw something in there too, Nathan?
Yes.
To me, it's that plus it's a reward system for the specific tribal beliefs of your own community. And I think that's a big deal, right? Because what we're looking at is whatever religious system one belongs to, they get to choose the measure of worthiness,
right?
That then gives the opportunity to participate in the reward that is the sacrament. So once again, kind of connected to a little bit of what we really talked about a lot in the temple admission process, this is a moving target. It really actually depends on faith tradition, but even inside of the faith tradition, it depends on the person who is in leadership. It depends on what they deem as the appropriate enough behavior to be worthy or eligible for the participation of the sacrament. Very similar to the what makes one worthy enough to be eligible for admission into the temple. So you'll notice that once again, the well-intended but very, very dangerous and unhealthy practice of humans sort of taking on a role that is really not theirs to take on comes into play once again in this realm of participation in the sacrament, very similar to that of the temple. And my thought about this is that in both cases, the solution is actually very, very simple. That human beings, whether or not they have priesthood power or any kind of leadership role, are not the judges. And there is no judge involved in this process. I would even go so far as to say Jesus Christ would never have wanted to be to have been given the role of judge. That is, I think, a reverse engineering of humanity giving a job to Jesus that he would not have applied for.
No, he would have been just completely inclusive.
Yes.
Under all circumstances. So I once read this joke from Anthony DeMello. He said, "What's the difference between a righteous judge and an unrighteous judge?" Answer: nothing. They're both judges and neither should be. And the point is that we just aren't capable of this. But I would even take it a step further. That to say humans aren't capable of judgment is absolutely correct. But I don't even think judgment is needed in this case. There's nothing to judge. Right? Somebody walks in the church and says, "Hey, I'm a convicted serial killer and I want to take the sacrament." Take it. Because your behaviors are independent of your desire to have a relationship with God, and far be it from me or anybody else to take away something that God administered to the people. It's not mine to take away from him. So if he's a serial killer, he's got to go through the steps or whatever it is, but that doesn't mean I take the sacrament from him.
Well, and what you're describing too is no matter what our wounds or our sins or our crimes are, what we need most is we need help, we need love. And we need the capacity to see ourselves as worthy of reparation. We need to have our hand held so that we can walk the steps of becoming healed.
Yes.
In the case of a criminal, say, for example, or a wounded or a sinner, which we all are wounded. All have made mistakes. Why would we get in the way of one wanting to come into closer contact with their creators so that they can be moving in the process of becoming made over in the image of God, right? Because when we're wounded, what we need is repair. We need reparation.
Right.
We need communion. We need connection. Yeah. We need everything that the sacrament is actually symbolic of. Why would we ever take this away? Okay, so we are just starting down this path because we're going to, as you all know, we've mentioned how we have big feelings about the withholding of the sacrament as a means of reward or punishment or power control. We've probably mentioned it a dozen times in other episodes. So that's probably why at some point in time, I was like, you know what? We need to just go there. We need to really focus on that. So here we are. Okay. So I want to just open, we have a whole list of things we want to talk about as far as the potential danger and damage done when we demand that somebody not take the sacrament. But to open that conversation up, I want to just refer her to Gregory Boyle in his book, Barking to the Choir, The Power of Radical Kindness. He says this, well, to give you a little bit of a background, he is, as I mentioned before, he's a Jesuit priest who has focused on Latino gangs in East Los Angeles. And he runs the largest gang rehabilitation and recovery program in the entire world. And so he has spent his entire ministry in prisons, in detention centers, and working with kids who are parts of some of the most, I guess, dangerous gangs in the country. So he says this, "When I celebrate masses in detention facilities, I remind folks before receiving the Eucharist that, as human beings, we often don't always get things right. So I welcome them to the human race, the whole catastrophe in all our imperfection, so that they will come to communion. I have taken lately to loosely quoting Pope Francis, who says that communion is not some grand prize for the perfect person, but rather food for the hungry one. And when the time comes, I try to get the congregation to embrace their collective hunger and to have a lighter grasp on perfection."
Mm.
This is not that complicated.
No, it's really not.
This is not that complicated. And God bless prophets like Gregory Boyle, who sees that these kids in detention halls longing for recovery, knowing that they have struggles, knowing that they've made mistakes that have caused them to be in prison, they want healing. They want to feel like there is hope that they can be healed. And so he gladly gives them the Eucharist and tells them, "Welcome to the human race."
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Isn't that incredibly beautiful? So let's just spend some time running through some ideas, Nathan, that you and I have spent some time talking about. When we think about what is going on philosophically behind the withholding of the sacrament, I think, first of all, let's just spend a moment talking about when we withhold, or when there is a theology that believes in the withholding of the sacrament, to me, it begins at the very top. It begins with a misunderstanding of the nature of God.
Mm-hmm.
This is a conditional God. This is a God that needs to be placated. This is a God that needs to be appeased. This is a God that needs to be, where we need to have a savior to stand between us and an angry, punitive God, and that we have essentially been put into timeout by the withholding of the sacrament. This is definitely a transactional God.
Right.
I see the foundation of the idea of asking people to not partake of the sacrament as a gross and tragic misunderstanding of the nature of our heavenly parents or our divine creators.
Yeah, well said. I think a couple things. Number one, I think of the Givens book, All Things New, where she talks about this idea of moving away from the imagery of God as our judge to our heavenly parents walking with us on the race, shepherding us through life, not waiting at the finish line to see if we were fast enough or not in our race. And when we can get rid of the schizophrenic nature of this God that we say is both loving and judging, both kind and, you know, immovable and unforgiving, you know, deeply caring and also jealous. We got to stop the schizophrenic God. I think of Adam Miller's concept that justice is giving us what we need. And if somebody's wounded, what they need is the sacrament or a sacrament, right?
Love, communion.
Love, communion, you know, exactly. And so, yeah, I think that a proper understanding of the nature of God and what the gods are trying to achieve with us is really critical to switching our framework around the sacrament.
Something else that was just pointed out to me very recently is that Jesus Christ never asked to be worshiped. There's no indication in any of the words or records of Jesus Christ in the New Testament to be worshiped, that he be worshiped. What Jesus asks of us is that we follow him. We follow him. And what did Jesus do? He gave himself over to love in life and then, of course, in death. And so if we can think about changing our relationship from one of our needing to sort of be, I'm thinking of a word. So if we could change our relationship from one of our being sort of pathetic sinners in need of saving, and more so that we are beautiful, good, worthy, genetically connected children of God in need of support, in need of a hand, in need of connection, it is through that kind of relationship that we are able to step forward and truly fulfill the measure of our creations. I've even heard, as sort of heterodox as this is, that worshiping and sort of bowing to God is really more perhaps, once again, a reverse engineering of how a liege lord demands the worship of their vassals. And that this is not really a relationship that I believe in terms of heavenly parents and myself as a child. Not to bow to, but rather that we become like them and that we are able to stand tall and see ourselves as always and everlastingly worthy. And when we see ourselves that way, we truly actually evolve into that kind of self.
Yeah. Richard Rohr says, we're always eternally in awe of God, but actually forget the one thing he said, which is to become like him, to become like Jesus Christ. You know, another thing that I want to just add to this, I've always thought it very interesting. We read the words of like Gregory Boyle or him quoting Pope Francis and being extremely generous in their nature and generous in their interpretation of giving grace and giving the sacrament. And it's like, I can only imagine that whatever our heavenly parents are like, that they are more kind and more generous and more forgiving and more open than even the greatest human beings that we come into contact with. So if Gregory Boyle and Pope Francis can be this kind, I only can imagine that our heavenly parents would be even more gracious, not less.
Yeah, very, very beautifully said, which kind of leads us to the next point. So we began with talking about our understanding of, or the current practice of demanding or requiring that certain people are sort of outside of the bands of mercy that allows them to participate in the sacrament. So that's what we're talking about here. What are the things, or what are the reasons why? What is the philosophy behind or under requiring someone not take the sacrament? We first started with a deep and profound misunderstanding of the nature of God. The next thing that kind of we just sort of naturally blended into talking about was a misunderstanding of the atonement of Jesus Christ. Is there anything else you want to add to that? I think we kind of covered these together, Nathan.
Only that I would just say that, again, it's always more generous and gracious and loving and open than we give it credit for.
Yeah.
Anytime you want to say, oh, the atonement doesn't cover this, or, you know, you haven't qualified for that, I'm just like, eh. Now, whenever there's a boundary put up, I just don't believe it.
Yeah. And my belief in the atonement is that we are infinitely lovable. And the more we accept the love that is always freely given us, the more we actually fulfill the measures of our creation, the more we actually begin to take upon ourselves the nature and essence of our own growing godhood. We lose the disposition to act in our fallen, wounded ways. It's not because we are shamed, but it's because we see ourselves as worthy that we become more and more like them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next. So the next piece of unhealthy theology that leads to denying people the sacrament is this concept of the transactional gospel of Jesus Christ. So I guess what I want to say here for a minute as I think about this one is, well, this is on my mind because I'm getting ready to collaborate with Steve Young on his book, The Law of Love. And his entire book, The Law of Love, talks about how the transactional gospel of Jesus Christ is definitely the lower law. It's what we do when we're learning how to be in connection with God. It's simpler. It's black and white. It is what Richard Rohr would call sort of first half of life ideology. But the idea is that this way of being in connection with God does not take us as far as it could. That the transactional gospel of Jesus Christ actually ceases to become helpful and actually becomes very, very hurtful. And so the idea is, with this transactional nature of God, it's like the vending machine God. I do this, you do that. Steve calls it the merit badge theology. And many of us, if we're going to be completely honest with ourselves here, connected to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we are very into transaction. We kind of believe that if we do this, then we get that. And this idea of giving the sacrament to the good kids and withholding the sacrament from the bad kids is 100% a case study of a transactional relationship with God.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And to me, the thing that jumps out would be the story of the prodigal son in the New Testament, which is a great, great parable. By the way, Jesus never calls the son the prodigal son, right? That's something we've given, a title we've given. But what I love about that story is that when the son wanders off and spends all his dad's money and runs off with harlots and does all of the things that we consider to be bad, and he comes to himself, the thing that he decides is that he's no longer worthy to be called a son. That is the punishment he feels like he deserves. And so he goes back to his dad and he says, I'm no longer worthy to be your son. Make me a servant. And the father, he doesn't even give the kid, you know, 2 seconds worth of attention to that statement. He's like, what are you talking about? You're my son. Let's go and have a party. He's like, no, I can't go into the party. I'm not worthy to be your son. And he's like, there's no such thing as not worthy to be my son. Your phrase makes no sense. You are my son because you are my genetics. You have my DNA. I love you as your father. It has absolutely nothing to do with what you've done, you know, the last 2 years with your life. And I think Jesus is absolutely setting up this idea that God's love, God's grace, God's mercies, God's blessings, his parties, and his fatted calves are for everybody. Everybody.
That's beautiful. And what you say actually brings us back to, it seems like we're giving quite a bit of homage to Adam Miller today, because Adam's interpretation of the prodigal son is very, very apt in this, because both prodigal sons, if you will, it's either they both are or neither of them are, as far as I'm concerned, right?
Right.
And so both of them have problems with the concept of transaction. The older brother sins because he thinks he deserves it.
Right.
And
the younger brother sins because he doesn't think he deserves
right.
it. That's their only sins.
Exactly right.
Is not understanding their relationship to their father and to each other.
They think they deserve or they don't deserve. They are in transaction with their father. And that is the only blindness that both of them suffer from.
Yep.
And so this concept of transaction needs to be addressed in Christianity. It needs to be addressed here in our own home faith, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We are not in a transactional relationship with God. And to the extent that we are, it actually paradoxically estranges us from God. And that is the thing, is it estranges us from God. It leads me to the next point, which is when we feel that we must constantly measure up to God, when we struggle with perfectionism because we are waiting to deserve God's love and God's reward, it actually makes us not only spiritually and soul sick, it actually can make us psychologically and relationally sick, which brings me to the concept of scrupulosity. That is the outcome of a chronic relationship with the idea that we have to be perfect to be beloved. It is a mental health condition that is caused by high demand religious systems that bring into a person a sense that they are never quite good enough for a very, very demanding God. And one of the ways in which we amplify the vulnerability that one has to suffer from the mental illness of OCD scrupulosity, which is obsessive compulsive disorder scrupulosity, or we call it spiritual scrupulosity, is by implementing actual experiences in public settings where people are rewarded or punished according to some sort of a arbitrary measure that is designated by the church system. And so we've got to be so careful that we are being gentle with the souls of people who, once again, remember from a couple of episodes ago, we sort of heightened and underscored the reason why people come to church to partake of the sacrament is we want to clear a path for them to feel beloved by God.
Yeah. And I think the worst thing that you can do is to have somebody that comes to church and then has a deacon, you know, hold the sacrament tray in front of them, and they have to wave him away and say, no, I can't. Okay. Because that enhances that whole feeling of shame. I'm not good enough for this. And that's just not the case. And so when we make people feel that way, we're putting them into this downward spiral instead of an upward spiral of come and participate and learn with us. It's a downward spiral of you don't really deserve to be here. You're not actually as good as we are. And not only that, but we're going to do something publicly so that all your neighbors sitting around you can see that you are not good enough to be with us.
I don't know how people have the strength and the courage to show up to a public service where they know that they have to be denied the sacrament. And it is a very, very public kind of setting that seems in some ways as if it is intentionally intended to shame someone. Now, maybe it's, I'm going to take that back. I don't know, and I want to believe that it is not intended to be shameful, but it is shameful.
Mm-hmm.
When we have a communal service, imagine inviting everyone to a dinner table at one of these kind of bonding sort of ritualistic food things that we talked about in our first episode of this series, and singling one person out and saying, but not today. You, sir or ma'am, don't get to participate in this ritualistic experience with the rest of us as we commune with one another.
Yeah. You can sit at the table, but you just can't eat the food with us. You have to watch us.
It is heartbreaking. And quite honestly, as I say this out loud, I don't know how we got here as a Christian community. How did we get here to where we would invite somebody in so that we could publicly tell them that they cannot participate in the taking of the bread and water, which represents a pathway to commune with God and their community. It's wrong. It's
crazy.
Y'all, it's wrong. Yeah. It's wrong. It's like a downward spiral, because what happens is what we're reinforcing in this kind of paradigm is we're reinforcing an internalized shame too. I am not good enough. The community is reaffirming or reinforcing that I am not good enough because a priesthood leader has told me that I cannot take the sacrament. And so I sit here and I sit here and experience this internal sense of my worth, my lack of worth, my lack of lovability, my not enoughness, that I am not good enough to sit at the feet of God and receive their love. And when I am better, I can be loved by my community, by myself, and by my God. It is antithetical to everything that we talk about in terms of healthy spirituality, which is just helping us learn how to see our lovability in the face of God, self, and others. That is the gospel of Jesus Christ that I understand.
It's the way I understand it too.
Okay, so let's just review quickly some of the unhealthy theology that leads to the denial of the sacrament. We talked about a misunderstanding of the nature of God, a misunderstanding of the nature of or the theology of the atonement. We talked about how it reinforces a transactional gospel of Jesus Christ, how it enhances the probability that people will struggle with OCD scrupulosity and perfectionism, and how this is potentially not only personally, but publicly shaming to people who are actually showing up at church wanting and deserving to be strengthened and loved by their community and shown that they are welcome to come to the table and be a human being like the rest of us. Hello, dear friends. As you probably know, I love creating the Latter-day Struggles podcast for you. I am so committed to providing you with frequent, honest, psychologically sound content to help you find faith, peace, confidence, and direction in your faith journey. However, I need your support. The content and the demands of this podcast have made it necessary for me to give up my previous work as a private practice therapist. As a way for you to show your support and gratitude for my work, I invite you to become a paid subscriber to this podcast, which will give you access to all of the Friday episodes. All Monday episodes will continue to be free of charge because I want you to be able to continue to know what we're exploring each week here on the podcast. So, for only $9.99 a month, you will not only continue to receive the content that has been so pivotal to your faith journey, but you can also help ensure that I can continue to serve this community. Your small cumulative contributions are already making such a difference. And also, you will be honoring the dedication, education, and commitment of a female Latter-day Saint professional who is brave enough to ask to be valued monetarily for her professional contribution to her community. Information on how to subscribe, information on how to become a monthly patron through my Patreon account, and also information on how to make a one-time donation through my professional Venmo account can all be found in my show notes at the bottom of each episode. So thank you so much for your ongoing support and trust. Now, back to the show. Okay, the next concept that we want to talk about that is, well, this is more of an outcome, is when someone is denied the sacrament, it perpetuates an unhealthy parent-child relationship with the institution and with the leadership. What I really feel like as I think about all the work that I've done and just in terms of like healthy psychology and healthy psychological development is as grown-up human beings, we really want to move out of any relationship that perpetuates a paradigm of parent and child with any sort of an authority figure. That's inclusive of church leaders, but it's also inclusive in the professional setting. And even with our, say, for example, our parents or our in-laws, we really want to move into adult to adult relationships, meaning that we are respectful and we may respect that people have positions of leadership around us for formal organizational reasons. But that in our interactions with them, we see ourselves as equals. And in this relationship with church leaders, where someone is, say, for example, under discipline, what they're actually participating in is a reinforcement of a parent-child relationship where it's like, I'm going to let you tell me what my status is before my parents in heaven. I don't believe that that is theologically sound or psychologically healthy.
Yeah, parent-child relationship, and you know, maybe a subset of that is any kind of intermediary. You know, I don't need you to tell me that I'm right or wrong because I don't need you at all. A bishop ought to open the meeting and be in charge of making sure the sacrament is prepared and have the speakers ready to go. But a bishop should not be a person that acts as any sort of intermediary between us and God. It's just not possible. You have to have a situation where we are moving people into a much healthier spirituality, which is where they connect with their parents in heaven directly. I can learn to talk to them and I can learn to have that communication, right? If there's something in my life where I'm acting out in a way that's not loving, I'm happy to have them tell me, but we've got to move away from this idea that I need another person to act as a God figure in my life.
Or some sort of a middleman.
Middleman.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
The way I see it is this, and I'm going to say this because I have been lucky enough to work with people in my therapy practice who have had extraordinarily good bishops. And here's what a good bishop is, everyone. A good bishop is a witness and a friend. A good bishop is someone who helps people see their infinite lovability and worthiness. And a good bishop is someone who always points a person to God and says, you are infinitely loved. Mm. And I am here to tell you that just in case for some reason you've forgotten. That's it.
Right.
That's what a bishop does. You are lovable. You are good. How can I support you as you find yourself?
Yes.
How can I support you? It is never punitive. It is never judgmental. It is never checking up on. It is never punishing. It is never withholding. What we would wish and what we want to invite anyone who has leadership is to help keep the lights on, make sure the organization runs, and point people to God and give people the confidence that they are always worthy to find God and have God in their lives, period.
Yeah.
It's so much more simple than I think we make it. Okay, the last thing that I want to do as we sort of talk about these unhealthy theological ideas that have led to the denying of sacrament is I want to go ahead and just become a little bit more, I guess, personal and share some things that I have learned from some beautiful and beloved people that I have had opportunities to work with in my Latter-day Struggles platform. I have had many people come to me. This is a repeated occurrence where people come to me in extreme distress, suffering trauma because they have been denied the sacrament. This has happened many times. It's happened to men and to women. And this is probably part of the reason why I feel so incredibly strongly about this, because I sit with these people and I hear the pain and suffering that is associated with the meaning that is made by being told that they are not worthy to take the sacrament. So I'm going to give a composite of some of the people that I've talked to kind of explain what this may feel like. What they have expressed to me is dread at coming to church, a lot of creative ways that they avoid being in the room when the sacrament is going on. They've talked to me about some very, very awful experiences of sitting in the chapel and lots of faces looking at them, lots of monitoring going on by some Orthodox people that want to make very, very sure that they don't take the sacrament. And maybe even more sadly, they talk about the impact that this has on their own children. I hadn't really thought about that until this came to my attention from a few different people. What is it that we're communicating to our children when we take our children to a church that won't let their parent participate in a communion with God? What are we teaching our children about the nature of God or about the nature of their religious institution that denies them access to God in a church building. This is a big deal. We are communicating something very, very unhealthy, very, very negative about the nature of God to sometimes very, very small children. I remember talking to an individual, a very, very faithful individual, who week after week would come home and tell their children and actually justify that the church was doing what they thought was best. And the children would say to this person, "Why is the church so mean to you? What is wrong with you? What have you done that you can't?" I mean, these children are so simple and they get it. They're like, "What could you possibly have done? You're a good parent. We love you." And this parent would just consistently say, "It's okay. It's not that big of a deal." And finally, I said to this person, "It's not okay. You need to stand up for yourself and stop defending an institution that is abusing you and teaching your children that God is angry and punitive. You need to tell your children that you deserve, as does all children of God, that you deserve to participate in a ritual of communion. And so please have the courage to stand up for yourself as a worthy and infinitely beloved human being, because you are those things and your children need to know that." And as I was sharing, and as I was talking to this individual, it's almost like the lights came on and they said, "You know, you're right. Why am I letting them tell me that I am not worthy? And why am I letting my children believe that about me and about God?" And so what we're all trying to do here, I think, is we are all trying to wrestle with the woundedness of humanity, of our institutions of faith. And we're trying to become healthy, and we're trying to help our institutions to become healthy. And sometimes it's situations of this nature, I think, that clearly shine a light on good theology and on not so good theology. Anything you want to say, Nath? I've been going on for a little bit.
No, it's beautiful. Very, very powerful.
Okay. Well, I think we are at a stopping point. What we're trying to communicate here, I guess, is that we value the sacrament. We value good, solid theology that creates community, that creates a clear path toward God, that encourages us to see one another as infinitely lovable and worthy. We want to look at anything that gets in the way of our finding access to our inner divine and our higher powers. And that is what we hope this episode has helped us think about and talk about, in hopes that as we become more spiritually sound as individuals and as institutions, that we all collectively can be more supportive of helping one another find Jesus Christ and come closer to our parents in heaven. Anything you want to say as we close today, Nath?
I want to just touch on one other issue regarding worthiness. This idea that you have to be worthy to take the sacrament probably originates from the writings of Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. In verses 27 through 29, he's very specific that one should not take the sacrament unworthily. And he doesn't really specify what that means, but he's pretty specific that there is kind of a worthiness test that should be run. And there is the possibility that it is that same writing of Paul that Joseph Smith may have been influenced by, where the wording of unworthiness appears in the Book of Mormon, specifically Jesus saying that no one should eat his body or drink his blood unworthily. Now, interestingly, Jesus never said that in the New Testament. That was Paul's writing. And so I suspect perhaps that may have influenced the way that Joseph translated that or produced that writing. But a couple thoughts on that. Number one, the way that the word unworthy is translated, Richard Rohr in his lectures on the Sermon on the Mount, he talks about the use of the word unworthy in the New Testament and gives it as his opinion that it might be better translated as unaware, which in context might make a little more sense, because basically he's just saying, if you participate in the sacrament unaware of its purpose and meaning, that it's essentially going to be ineffective. And that jives, because we've been talking about how a sacrament or a ritual is something that should bring us into presence and is something that should connect us to a deeper meaning and to the divine. And if we're just going through the motions, or if we have no idea what the motions are even supposed to be, then it can't have that same connecting meaning. The other thing about Paul's writing in 1 Corinthians 11 is that I think you have to take into consideration that it is, in fact, Paul. This is the same man who wrote that women should submit themselves to their husbands, that women should cover their faces anytime there's a prayer, that women should not speak in church, that men should not wear their hair long. And the same Paul that defended the institution of slavery, telling slaves to submit to their masters, and even indicating that slavery was appointed by God. So whether the wording on that has been translated poorly, or whether we're just seeing another example of Paul, who was probably a mystic. He seemed to certainly understand the concept of the inner divine and God experience, but seemed to be maybe not quite as skilled at dealing with religion playing out in our day-to-day lives. He was seemingly very influenced by culture. He was constantly at odds with Peter over taking the gospel to the Gentiles, over circumcision. They're just, in terms of the day-to-day operations of our lives, his mysticism never quite seemed to translate over very well. And so I just take those verses with a grain of salt.
All right. Thank you all so much for being here with me and Nathan on the Latter-day Struggles podcast. If there's anything else that we can do to support you, jump over to latterdaystruggles.com, where I have a wealth of growing information and content for you. I am starting something called a Latter-day Solutions library, where I have monthly classes that are called my Latter-day Night Live classes. So please come to those. They're once a month on a Wednesday night. They are inclusive of a presentation, a beautiful digital workbook, and a synchronous question answer session. Jump over to my podcast. No. Jump over to my website to know what the topic is each month. And then afterwards, they will be recorded and available for purchase. Also, if you want to subscribe to this podcast, I would really encourage you to do so. Creating the content that Nathan and I create takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of professional time. And I do it with all my heart and soul, but I really do appreciate your monetary support so that I can continue to do this in the long run. This is my job. And if you're interested in any one-on-one coaching with me or with my team for long-term, I would be temporary. They would be long-term. Jump over to latterdaystruggles.com. And finally, we are a proud member of the Dialogue Podcasting Network. They are the founding organization for progressive Mormon thought. And I am proud to be associated with them. Thank you all for being here, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Dialogue Podcast Network.